Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week at the kitchen table, which just happens to be right in the middle of the studio of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We're right downtown on Douglas Avenue in the old Pantorium building. Yes, we are, and we are community radio, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes, the Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, you can go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Thank you to our supporters. Thank you to you for tuning in today. Oh, despite the weather going hot, cold, and today it's kind of
and
miserable.
And wet.
Well, we did get a little time in the garden this weekend, didn't we, Donna? We did get out there and we
I did.
Dug
I
around.
Pulled out a lot of Creeping Charlie to make room for a few flowers.
There we did. I'm doing that too. And while I was doing that, actually I was kind of out along the road picking up some things. I happened to notice one good thing that Creeping Charlie was for. Right along the road was this great big line of Creeping Charlie. All the purple flowers are out. And I watched a couple of hummingbirds just go right down the road. Sip, sip, sip,
oh,
sip,
yeah,
sip.
Lots of bees in the Creeping Charlie, too.
Oh, I thought, well, I'll just leave that there for you, sir. You did really good. It's good to get into the dirt and dig this time of year. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we'll consider some news items.
Oh, yeah. This is rant day. Lana and I each have a few things that we want to go on about, so you'll have to bear with us.
Yeah,
or you can just turn the volume down. But
things we should know. Everything, surprisingly, there's a lot of things that are connected to our food system, and we're concerned about food systems and the
food
environment.
Food and agriculture.
Oh, yes,
hello
we
there.
Do. Well, yes, we do. Also, we'll to kind of go along with our good news, bad news, we've got a little bit of sourness from, we're going to look into rhubarb a little
right,
bit.
Right, and that little tape that we're going to play, yeah, that might be the happiest part
of
the show.
Little up,
so enjoy that, and then we're going to launch into it.
Oh, it sounds kind of ominous there. We got some of the things, too. We'll look at a local wildwood flower later, too. But hang on to your hats. We've got some news items that we would like to share for you from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick. That's the ticker tape. We do have a news department here. Don and I kind of like to bring you stuff that we have run across. I would like to talk for a few minutes here about the farm economy and spring planting. It is spring. Farmers are planting. And, yes, there's this farm economy thing. We don't think about it much if you're not a farmer, and there is a farm crisis. I was reading an article by Jim Hightower. Jim Hightower is a writer, a commentator. He was a past agricultural commissioner.
Yeah, and the word farm crisis came up first in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. The farm crisis means when the farmers are basically having to produce below the cost of production, which means they can't make any money. They can't pay their either farmland mortgages or their equipment loans. And after about 3 years, it gets bad, bad, bad. This was like in the 1980s when we had a record number of farm bankruptcies. And I must add that the farmer suicide rate goes up during these things. So we are in another farm crisis.
You may have not heard a lot about this in the news, but it is there, and it's not so good. Today's crisis promises not only to devastate our country's rural economy and culture, but also it enters our kitchens and just may bite us on the butt, according to Jim Hightower, as was true. It also happened in the late 1800s and, as Donna said, in the 1980s. So how severe is this storm? Let's start with one eye-popping indicator, the 2018 median income for farms was minus $1,553. That's median income for farms.
That means you put all of this effort into raising a crop like corn or soybeans, and the market price is less than it costs you, not counting your labor, but the cost of your inputs and things like that, you are losing money when you're working hard. That's not good.
This is not good. We should all be concerned about this. So tune your ears here. Such hard times are not a one-time blip. This has been happening for six straight years that more than half of American ag producers have lost money. Not so good. But if they're good farmers, why are they going broke? And this is what Jim Hightower says. Because corporate middlemen, commodity speculators, and government policy have intentionally perverted the structure of U.S. ag economy to leave producers with practically no say over the prices they receive. For the past several years, for instance, dairy farmers are in the fourth consecutive year of incomes below production. In 2018, they got $1.35 for each gallon of milk, but it costs them $1.90 to produce. This can't go on. This is not good. So the number of American dairy farms has dwindled from 70,000 to only 40,000. That's just from 2007 to today. This is not good, folks. This is not good at all.
So even with subsidies, here's the issue. The middlemen or the agricultural corporations, which it's either the processors of milk or the seed and chemical companies, they're still making money. It's the farmers and the consumers.
Here's a little bit of
who lose out.
Chicken economy here. Chicken producers, they're not doing too good either. So let's say you get a great big bucket of fried chicken, your family size, your picnic size, and it costs you $28.99. The corporation that contracts with the farmers to raise the birds takes $5. The chicken processor, distributor, and retailer take $23.41, and the farmers who grew the chickens and took all the risk get $0.58.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds not so good. Bad news. Bummer news.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to raise our own chickens like you do.
Well, that's good. Yeah, you find out kind of it's a process and it works too.
Yeah, that old saying, oh, it's just chicken feed, meaning it's not very much money.
Chicken feed is getting pricey.
A little pricey too.
Yeah. So that was some information from Jim Hightower. Remember, less than 15 cents of your food dollar now goes to farmers. Think of that.
I had heard as low as 11 cents per dollar.
Now, also, I have a news item to share from Art Cullen. Art Cullen is the managing editor of the Progressive Populist.
Yes, our very own Iowan Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist.
He works for the Storm Lake Times in northwestern Iowa, and I like to keep up on what he says because he's kind of right in the middle of Iowa. He knows what's going on. This is a few excerpts here from an editorial he wrote, Planting on Hope. Green sprigs are sprouting along the ditches. And it's that anxious and hopeful time of the year. Oh, the smell of diesel and the smell of spring. The farmers are monitoring every day and trying to get in the field and plant those seeds. And that they would soon explode into the fields and do it all. The good Lord willing and the creek don't rise. In a month, all those things will be up. That's the hope part. And then there's the anxious part. Some farmers are still trying to get financing. What cash they had from the ethanol boom of 10 years is past. There's this trade war on. We seem to be fighting with everybody. And we still haven't got a deal with Mexico and Canada in this new thing that'll update NAFTA. Nothing's a done deal, so farmers are waiting. That's anxious. Southwest Iowa was washed out this spring. There'll be no corn planting on thousands of acres there. Or several springs to come for what was given up to the muddy Missouri. So farmers have lost money so many years in a row that they could get used to it if it weren't fatal. But another year or two of down markets, delayed machinery maintenance, and rolling over old loans, and you could start to have a serious conversation. Farm suicide rates are rising to their highest level since the 1980s farm crisis. Nobody we heard is talking about opening up that lame farm bill and actually doing something about it. So we wait with hope and anxiety. We occupy ourselves with hope that markets will swing up. They've been known to. That we will produce a yield like we've never seen before. Well, it happens. We plant on hope. That's a few words from Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times in northwestern Iowa. A few things about the farm economy and spring planting. So we're going to be talking about other news items today, and Donna has got something to say about the sun will show up. It will be summer.
Tomorrow, maybe we're going to have sun. We'll see. Mm-hmm. But there has been, of course, with summer season coming, there's been a blitz of articles. I've seen this issue in multiple print forms. We're talking about sunscreen, okay? Of course, we need to have sunscreen. However, and we have talked about this in past years, there are sunscreens and there are sunscreens. This is not to say don't wear sunscreens, but there is new research showing that some of the ingredients in some sunscreens, not only does it bleach coral reefs, which is not particularly nice, but we're in Iowa. We're not worrying about the coral reef in the middle of the Skunk River. But it's quite obvious now from scientific studies that the chemicals that you put on your nose are absorbed in through your skin and are not particularly good for you. So the best research, and we have touted this before, is to go to the Environmental Working Group's website. They have a very good, highly researched, by brand name, they tell you which sunscreens are A, effective, and B, safe. So before you buy your sunscreen for the summer, take a look. Learn which chemicals in the sunscreen, and they have some, it's not quite like reading labels in food, which are hard enough to understand, but cosmetic and those kinds of ingredients, there are a lot of chemicals. Some are fine and some are not. So I would highly recommend the Environmental Working Group's website for looking up sunscreens. They go by brand. They say, okay, this one is the best. This one is the worst. These are in between. So think about what you're putting on your own skin, on your children's skin. Just do a little research on this one, folks. We have talked about this before. The evidence is mounting once again. So for sunscreen season, do be careful. Not all the things on the grocery store shelves or at the pharmacy. Not all of them are created equally safely.
Good news. Well, good news, bad news.
Well, there's a way to deal with it, We're not helpless consumers, okay?
Also, I have a note to all of the fine folks out there. Wear a hat.
Absolutely.
That's something I had to learn. I don't burn very easily. I do, but I don't. And so I've always traipsed around outside in sandals and shorts and bare head. I've learned to just get a hat that you're going to like, that just kind of becomes part of you.
You're not going to sweat in.
Yep. Just kind of becomes part of you, and you can be out there, and you can be weeding your onions, knowing that your head isn't at least not baking off.
Well, and there are other things. Now, we do need some sun. We have to have a little mm-hmm. vitamin D so that, don't do your main gardening in the middle of the day, okay? Early morning is better or later evening because the sun's rays are not as vicious as it were.
Yes, a little break, a little siesta is not uncalled for anyway. So be careful out there this summer. It's
be
coming.
Be sensible.
Sunshine. Oh, the sunshine does bring plants growing. And one of the things that pops up this time of year, everybody's got an opinion on it, you'd think, because everybody likes to talk about it. Big seller at farmer's market. Rhubarb.
Oh, now we're going to do our most pleasant part of the show, a little bit about rhubarb.
Yes, I went into the archives and got a little bit of what we said about rhubarb a few years ago, and it is still apropos for today. There is who remembers? Gildy probably remembers this. There was a band called Silly Wizard. along about the 70s and 80s. And there was some singers in there that would kind of revive old English tunes. And they had a series of things about kind of music that people would sing on the streets to hawk their wares. And this is one of them.
Are you going to tell me you have a Rhubarb Sellers song?
There's this thing that is stuck in my head ever since rhubarb came up as a topic this week. And here's how it goes. And this one connects up rhubarb to the country of Turkey, because you'll find out. It goes like this. Turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb, turkey rhubarb I sell. I come here from Turkey to make you all well. Oh, don't you know me? My name it is Sam, 'cause I am the celebrated turkey rhubarb man. That's the kind of thing that you'd sing if you were trying to gather up business. So that one attributes rhubarb to the turkey rhubarb man, but it also does allude to the fact that it is medicinal. We need a lot of extra oomph in the spring,
yep,
and rhubarb
spring cleaning.
Yeah.
Now the thing is, rhubarb is, I don't know why it's a turkey rhubarb, because it's actually a northern plant. I mean, it takes cold weather.
Well,
you don't eat rhubarb usually in Mediterranean cuisine.
Well, Turkey's way up there. They've got like mountains where apples and stuff come from too. So
yeah. Okay.
Anyway, he was probably a middleman anyway. Who knows? Sam the turkey rhubarb man. I don't know.
Well, the usual things with rhubarb, as we all know, it goes quite well with cinnamon. The traditional one that I grew up with, of course, is nutmeg, and a little nutmeg in the rhubarb with sugar. Of course, everybody loves strawberries with it, but citrus is really good. Orange and rhubarb are one of my favorites.
Oh, I discovered a wonderful combination, rhubarb and orange marmalade. Huh?
She makes a good one.
Now, that's the kind of thing to make this time of year. You have to slice the oranges and boil them in sugar water, kind of
With the skins on,
until the slices are translucent, and then you can
like
go on.
Like a marmalade.
Marmalade, yeah. And then you can kind of go on. But that combination, just rhubarb by itself is kind of, it's rather assertive. And the orange sort of helps. Yes, it is. And we have on the Donalana Kitchen website, there is a page of recipes there. And one of the first recipes we put up way back, it was about 2014, maybe?
Yes, we're always, this time of year, we have to do rhubarb.
Yeah, well, there's a recipe there called Bernice's Really Good Rhubarb Dessert. And Bernice Donovan is not with us anymore, but a fine woman who lived here in Ames. And check out that Really Good Rhubarb
Dessert. You know, rhubarb is also good for savory things, too.
Who would have thought?
Something that, you know, you need a little tang. I did run across a rhubarb bacon compote recipe.
Bacon.
Bacon, which includes bacon, onion, rhubarb, maple syrup, because, of course, it's very tart, red wine vinegar, a little allspice, and a little thyme. I think I might even try to make that.
Oh, what does one put with that? Does that
compote? Yeah. Oh, well, you could, something like this, you could serve it on chicken, or you could even put it on toast, or, you know, it's a, instead of ketchup kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
It's got that sweet sour tang thing to it.
We talked about ketchup on a past show, and there are other things to eat besides ketchup. There are other food enhancers, fun little things. That sounds good, yes. Good.
Oh, you know, the other thing, I think we did this last summer, so we may have talked about it, making rhubarb syrup. So you're going to take your rhubarb and chop it up with some water, and then you're going to cook it slowly for as long as 2 hours. Just make sure it has plenty of water. And then eventually you kind of strain the rhubarby out of it, and you've got very strongly flavored liquid to which you add syrup. Then you've got rhubarb syrup. You could use it in cocktails. I mean, a good thing would be like a little in the summer Prosecco with rhubarbs, or champagne, or white wine with rhubarb syrup. That would be an easy one. Or it makes a lovely addition to lemonade, or instead of lemonade, with just, you know, adding water and, you know, because the rhubarb is the sour. So you could just add bubbly water and the rhubarb and have a rhubarb soda, a rhubarb fizz, as it were.
So all that stuff growing up there.
Then you put a little gin in it.
Have at it. Have at it, yes. All that rhubarb growing out there.
Oh, also, you know, rhubarb, don't you freeze it? I this time of year when we get a lot of it, it's so easy to freeze. I just chop it up. I don't blanch it. I don't do anything. I just chop it up, put it in freezer bags, and in she goes.
Yes. So plan on enjoying that rhubarb. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa.
And again, tree back in 83, there he did meet young Sarah McRae. The wild rose of morning, that pale flower dawning, the herald of springtime in his young life that day. Sarah, she could not see the daylight of reality. In her young eyes, Billy bore not a blow. Knowing not her chosen one, it was a hired gun, wanted back in Kansas City by the law. Then one day a tall man came riding o'er the Badland, flying to the north of New Mexico. He was overheard to say he was looking for Bill Gray, a ruthless man and a dangerous outlaw. And the deadly news came creeping to Billy fast sleeping there in the Clarendon Bar and Hotel. He fled toward the old church upon the outskirts, thinking that he'd climb up to the old steeple bell.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Oh, we were talking about rhubarb. Yes, we were. And I mentioned, before that little musical break, I mentioned orange rhubarb jam, which has become a real favorite around my house, I tell you. And I got that from a book that Donna tuned me into by Christine Ferber called Mes Confitures. It is a French jam and jelly book. It is thankfully translated into English. Mes Confitures, the Jams and Jelly by Christine Ferber. And it is a fine book just to get you inspired. I got that rhubarb orange jam from that book. Thank you, Donna. Ah. So, Donna, I think we're back to our news items.
We got some more books here to talk about.
Oh, books.
Okay, so there was an article in The Atlantic fairly recently, the magazine The Atlantic. The title is Eat Food, All the Time, Period, Mostly Junk. The subtitle, How the Food Revolution Turned Us into Snackers, Guaranteeing the Demise of Healthy Home Cooking.
Ooh.
The article is written by Laura Shapiro, who is a food historian. I think she's a historian. Her my favorite book of hers, and we have talked about her before, is Perfection Salad, where she talks about really the industrialization of food. And she has other books. So she is reviewing two books in The Atlantic called The Way We Eat Now, How the Food Revolution Has Transformed Our Lives, Our Bodies, and Our World by B. Wilson, and Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It by three people, Sarah Bowen, Jocelyn Brinton, and Seneca, or something like that, Elliot. But basically what they're talking about in this article, and this is the rant part, and one of my most important ranting subjects is, you know, what industrialization of the food and processed food has done. It used to be just to Americans, but I'm afraid it's global at this point.
So B. Wilson points out in the way we eat now, and I'm going to read some of this straight from the article. Junk food has overwhelmed traditional diets pretty much everywhere in the world and at an astonishing speed. This revolution is making massive numbers of people fat and sick. Okay, so there we have it, the obesity crisis, which sprang from this transformation of, you know, making real food from scratch to buying food that has been processed by large corporations to feed to masses of people. She goes on and says, this is Laura Shapiro, the manufacturer of packaged foods saw the 1960s very differently. She talks earlier in the article about in the 60s, sort of the hippie group had a cultural transformation, of course, in many ways that we're all familiar with, one of which has resulted in farmers markets, gourmet food, the healthy eating revolution, da, 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 da. That has affected many of people. However, the opposite also happened. The two things kind of split. People eat either one way or the other and feel very strongly about it. So she's saying, okay, this one branch did healthy food. The other branch, the manufacturers of packaged foods, saw the 60s very differently. From their viewpoint, it was a victory decade, the time when homemakers were finally getting comfortable with the ideas that boxes and jars belonged at the center of their cooking. Okay. By the 60s, however, the resistance to packaged foods had abated, and speed, convenience, and, quote, the addictive, get this, addictive, and that is not used as hyperbole. The addictive nature of salt and sugar had done the trick, aided by, of course, voluminous advertising. So what she's saying here is that many people changed their eating habits from the 60s onwards by the things they were buying at the grocery store, which were aided with lots of advertising pushing people to do that, but also the formulations of these products caused us in our inherent nature to love, because we love salt and sugar, we have added a lot of salt and sugar to our diet. It says, this winning formula proved to be just as successful not only in America, but in Canada and Britain and other wealthy countries. Within a couple of decades, a huge swath of the population on both of the sides of the Atlantic was eating any way people had never eaten before. They dropped away from old fashioned meals, even from tap water, in favor of soft drinks and all day snacking. Many people are scarcely acquainted with the feeling of hunger anymore. I have to say, I totally, totally agree with this new pattern is a series of solitary snacks that we often hardly notice or enjoy as they pass through our gullet. Today, a third of all the calories consumed by American adults comes from chips, protein bars, and the like. Soft drinks have had an especially pernicious impact. In America, consumption of them took a big leap in the 70s. That's 40 years ago, folks. And with that came unprecedented rates of obesity. After conquering the West, the same denatured, heavily processed foods marched on through the rest of the world like an army of high-calorie invaders. Over just 11 years, from 1988 to 1999, Wilson reports, the number of overweight and obese people in Mexico nearly doubled.
Oh, boy.
Hello.
You mentioned the 60s as kind of a turning point where, yes, some people were discovering whole grains. But a whole bunch of other people, I can't remember how many food jingles I probably still remember, because I thought if I heard it on television and Tony the Tiger was telling me, and if,
absolutely,
and
if, we grew up with this.
Yes, and if I could sing those things, and that must make it good.
Okay, so, but if yeah. Lana and my generation, and we are approaching elderly.
Yes, we are.
If we grew up with it, that means that most people who are younger than we are have had it their whole lives. They did not even know any other world existed, right?
And you mentioned the idea of not knowing hunger. And I don't mean just a little peckish.
No,
I mean hunger.
Well, we're not. It's true. And this has always been a good guide for people who want to lose weight. If you wait until you actually feel hunger, then you know it's time to eat. And it's going to come. But if we never have our, if we're always having a little snack here or a cup of tea and a little biscuit there or something, we never reach that place where our body signals us and we lose that physical ability to go, oh, yeah, I'm hungry.
Oh goodness. I'm
afraid. My stomach is growling.
I'm afraid this being America and this being capitalism at its best that we'll probably have to go to hunger workshops to figure out how this all works.
Yeah, we're not talking about starvation here. We're talking about normal physiological responses to when your stomach growls, that means, oh, it's probably a good time to feed it something nourishing.
Nourishing.
But we often don't even get to the hunger thing. Or when we do, we reflexively grab the nearest thing at hand rather than being prepared with a meal. The writer of this article says, turning the pages of these two books, I wondered whether it was time to jettison my long-held belief that the best way to counter the food industry is to actually cook meals from scratch. So she talks about in the pressure cooker book, it's about not a pressure cooker, but it is about the pressure that mothers are under to feed their family dinners. She says maybe that's not practical because, I mean, and here we're it's a class war thing. You know, if you are fortunate enough to go to the grocery store and shop and buy whatever you want and you can cook kale once a week or three times a week or something. But if you're not, if you are living on either food stamps or food pantry and
Or working three jobs.
Yeah. And you just want to get food into your family so that their stomachs aren't growling, that's not an option. It's just, you know, so it becomes a political and economic and class issue. Wilson, for her part, the author of the book about pressure cooking, isn't fussy about whether the food is cooked at home or somewhere else. She just wants it to be nutritious and delicious. Her own extensive reporting indicates persuasively that the most effective way to counter the toxic food system is with government regulation. Mm-hmm. In Amsterdam, there are countries that are doing this. In Amsterdam, fast food advertising is strictly controlled with no sweets or sodas allowed in schools, and obesity rates among the children have dropped by 12% since the rule was imposed in 2012.
12%?
12%. Oh. 3 years ago, Chile passed what Wilson calls the most aggressive range of laws against unhealthy foods that the world has yet seen, including an 18% soda tax, a ban on using cartoon characters to market breakfast cereals. Packaged foods high in salt, sugar, or fat now can carry prominent black labels identifying the products as unhealthful. And a survey shows that some 40% of Chileans shop with these labels in mind. She goes on to say, It is hard to imagine American politicians pushing back with such vigor against the food industry. All the focus on nutrition, food safety, and all the celebrity activism is no match for the ferocious lobbying of big agricultural and industrial food producers. Some pretty effective brainwashing has been done too. And then she talks about how we've been advertised to think that healthy choices, you know, we can make healthy choices simply by turning to reformulated versions of familiar products like low-fat chips, reduced-fat cookies, sugar-free sodas, all-natural frozen burritos. Meanwhile, one of the industry's most resounding successes is to have retrained our culinary sensibilities, not merely our palates. Whenever we feel hungry or even just a sense that mealtime is hovering, an ever-ready yen for something, anything with a familiar brand name kicks in. So it's not, you know, whether you are rich or poor, we are all kind of subjected to this brainwashing. Her final sentence in this article, and I could not agree with it more, cooking isn't a luxury. It is a survival skill. To understand where your food is coming from, to read labels. I mean, this is really what Lana and I try and do here all the time, is encourage you to not just cook, but to understand all the things that you're eating, what you're shopping for, what the ingredients mean. You know, there we are making choices that affect personally our health levels. We think they are aesthetic choices. Oh, what do you prefer for dinner, dear? Oh, this, that, and the other. But the long-term health, not everything is in your diet, but it's a huge contributing factor to heart disease, to obesity, to all of the things that are health problems in our country. And it has environmental effects as well. So, you know, let's be educated eaters. Let's not just be dummies and go along. This is a cultural we think of politics as who we vote for or, you know, different laws and subsidies. But really, there is a politics of food and culture. The history of our culture resides not in who was president in 1862, but what people ate and how they lived and what quality of life and satisfactions of life they had. And there is a lot that we do control. I'm not saying don't vote. That's terribly, terribly important. But vote with your dollars, too. Think how you spend your money. Think and be, you know, think about the sunscreen that you're buying and, you know.
Yeah, and I often mention
it's complicated.
On this show that we are all in this together. Think of how of what you buy, what you eat, affects those that grow what you eat. The farmers are the producers of this stuff that we eat, and I'm afraid so much of it has been hijacked into things that are not really all that good for us. I don't know that much about ethanol, but it doesn't seem like something I want to eat. So there's all of this stuff affects us.
Well, and that goes full circle to what we were talking about earlier. For example, the farmers have not made money since the ethanol boom, right?
Okay. Boom.
There was an economic time, not so within the last 10 years, where farmers were making a lot of money off of corn because the ethanol industry came along. But then what happened? The ethanol industry has some problems, right? And then, of course, the farmers suffer.
Right. Perhaps we can, like, get back to growing and eating good food. That would be good.
Right. Can you imagine all those acres of corn and soybeans that are planted that are not really for human consumption? This can't go on forever.
Right. Right. We know how to do things the right way. And I
well,
think
and some of it, it's we're figuring this out. You know, there's new research on what else we can grow, mixed grains, cover crops, you know, because we're losing soil, we're putting our water quality is degrading, our farmers are not making any money, and our population in general, the health is declining. Hello! What's going on with this picture?
Oh, for goodness sakes.
But change is slow.
Thanks for sharing that article. Rick, what was the name of the article again? By Laura Shapiro.
Yeah, and it was in The Atlantic. Where did my cover story go? It had had a very catchy title. It was 20 pages long, so Lana, I can't find the title page. Oh, yes. Yes. Eat food all the time, mostly junk. That's kind of a parody on Michael Pollan's saying, which is eat food... mostly vegetables, something like that. I've forgotten
not
the quote.
Not too much.
Not too much, yeah.
Mostly plants.
Mostly yeah. Plants, yes. So
there you go.
Right.
We'll come back and we'll talk about other stuff on the Donalana Kitchen. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org. You can go there, find the Donalana Kitchen page. We got archives. We got recipes. Support this fine community radio station. Thank you. back. This is the Donnell in the Kitchen. That's some of the music of Norman Blake. Norman Blake's been around as a folk musician and a fine guitar player for a long time. That was a tune called Salty. Salty. Oh, yeah, that is a kitchen connotation.
Yeah, salt and sugar. Remember, they are literally, your body wants more of them. And if you want to reduce them in your diet, you can. You can slowly cut down both the salt and the sugar, and your tongue will adjust to that. Like, I've been reducing sugar in my diet, and now if I buy a milk chocolate bar, it tastes way too sweet to me.
Yeah, yeah.
We are capable of there's a technical term.
Downloading.
Yeah, anyway, reducing that, and our bodies will adjust just fine.
Yeah.
Salt and sugar.
Yum. And fat. Fat is fat, good, too. Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, there are good fats and there are bad fats. We'll cover that in another
topic. That's a whole nother show. Anyway, Donnell in the Kitchen, we've been talking about news items, and we had a little bit of thought about rhubarb. I'd like to kind of swing out into the woods here and enjoy something that has just, I've been noticing, it's just blooming all over the place. Jack in the Pulpits seem to be really thick.
Oh, aren't
this
they there?
Year.
They're, I think, the first plant that children are usually taught to identify because they're so darling and so obvious. And you can take a kid in the woods, and if you've shown him a picture, he can usually find one.
You can usually find it. They're right up there. They're not small either. You know, they're a couple foot or two high. And oh, okay.
And the charming name, it's Jack in the Pulpit.
Yes.
Okay.
Jack in the Pulpit. Aracema triphyllum. That's what it's called. It's called Jack in the Pulpit. It's also called, of course, something else. It's also called bog onion, brown dragon, Indian turnip, and the American wake robin. I like that. American wake robin.
Wake robin. Hmm.
It's an herbaceous perennial plant growing from a corm. Think of irises. Irises have corms. They're not a bulb that looks like an onion.
Right.
They're kind of this snarly-looking thing that grows sideways.
And they spread.
And boy, did they spread this year. It used to be, go out in the woods, oh, look, there's a Jack in the Pulpit. Haven't seen one of those. I see them by the dozens now, and they are really a welcome thing. It grows 12 foot to 2 feet tall and has three.
2 feet tall? Oh,
yeah,
my.
Yeah, mine are
really
tall. And it's got these three leaves on the top. They kind of look like giant poison ivy, but it's not. I mean, it's those fingered leaves, and there's three of them. And usually you think leaves of three, let it be. But this doesn't look anything like poison ivy. But, yes, they have three
leaves.
Right,
they're not pink at all.
Two. No, not at all. Okay. And then the most wonderful thing is that the flowers are contained in what is called a spadix, that is covered by a hood, this little hood.
That's the pulpit, right?
That's the pulpit, and Jack lives in there.
Jack is the flower.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Jack in the Pulpit. It is native to eastern North America, occurring in moist woodlands and thickets from Nova Scotia, west to Minnesota, south to Florida and Texas. So I was kind of just on the western edge of that, and we are glad to have
them.
And we
have a lot
here.
Of moist thickets this
we
year.
We do. It's nice to see them. Seedlings of Jack in the Pulpit need 3 or more years of growth before they become large enough to flower. And if you let the Jack in the Pulpit go to seed, actually you'll notice that little Jack in there turns into a little clump of red berries, and that's the seeds. I mean, eventually it has to be pollinated and it has to go through its stuff. But there's little red seeds that happen there.
So I suppose they propagate by the corm as well, right?
It might. At least, I don't know. But the berries, 1 to 5 seeds on each little stalk does that. Yeah. So the plant contains calcium oxalate. And
it's a useful plant.
Yeah, it is. Because of this, consumption of raw plants results in a powerful burning sensation. It can cause irritation of the mouth and digestive system. So be careful. I mean, don't eat this stuff.
Yeah, don't eat it. It's poisonous, basically.
People have used it for in proper doses for medicines, of course. Native Americans used to treat sore eyes, and preparations were used to treat rheumatism, bronchitis, and snake bites, as well as to induce sterility.
Oh,
write that down.
All right. So don't
eat
let's
this.
Let's not make medicine out of this one.
No, it's a little
complicated. It's sort of like the belladonna, which makes digitalis, which is a heart medicine, but it also can kill you.
Be careful. Be careful out there.
Did you say this was used as a poison also by traditionally?
History and folklore, it says. One account from the Meskwaki Indians states that they would chop the herb's corm, and mix it with meat and leave the meat out for their enemies to find. The taste of oxalate would not be detected because of the flavored meat, but consuming the meat reportedly caused their enemies pain and death. So watch out. And, ooh, those tricky Meskwaki Indians. Oh, my goodness.
A form of ancient warfare.
Also, they used it to determine the fate of the sick by dropping a seed in a cup of stirred water. If the seed went around four times clockwise, the patient would recover. If it went around less than four times, they would not.
Ooh. Well, that would be good to know in advance, wouldn't it?
Well, not really, but there it was. Write all this stuff down. And so a little nod to Jack in the Pulpits, our Samia, Triphyllum Jack in the Pulpit. Oh, I like the name American Wake Robin. Doesn't it sound good?
Just don't eat it.
Don't eat it. Don't eat it. Oh, there's another little news item.
Oh, right. We had a little happening in Iowa City.
There is, remember we talked about Greta Thunberg from
she's Swedish, right? The teenager from Sweden who's on the climate change crisis.
Yeah, right. She's been striking, and they think that young people can't do anything. There was an article on the Common Dreams website, an article by a young man called Massimo Paciotto Biggers. Isn't that a great name? Massimo Paciotto Biggers. And he is on climate strike in his town of Iowa City, Iowa, and he's been on the strike for 9 weeks, not going to school on Friday afternoons. And he's been gathering a lot of attention. Good for him. Actually, people started to take notes. Other students are joining him. And 1 week, an NFL star named Tim Dwight showed up to be a speaker. He talked about solar panels and kind of helped him out there. And on week six, Iowa Poet Laureate Mary Swander came and read from one of her plays and talked about climate change. Massimo says, I want to have a future. There's no sense of urgency about doing anything about climate action in our Iowa City school district. Everyone knows it. Everyone knows how cheap solar is. That's something we could do. He wants three things: solar on all school buildings in the district, a climate curriculum in all schools, and an overall 50% emission cuts by 2030. So there you go. He's doing his thing.
Yeah, from the mouths of babes. I mean, and they're doing a good job and getting, you know, and pointing out, rightly so, us old fogies that, you know, our generation has not done a particularly good job on this.
We talk about our taste for fats and salts. We like our good things. We are fat and happy here in the middle of the country.
Yes, we have been snowed for a good, maybe, well, certainly I will acknowledge that in my lifetime, the corporate influences in all kinds of ways. So the oil and gas industries, they don't want to talk about climate change. They're making out like bandits and taking all the money to the banks. And the same thing with the food processing industries. Just try and think about this. Who's benefiting from these difficult social concerns?
Oh. There was some place that is no longer calling it a climate.
Oh, yes.
The
Guardian magazine announced this week they are no longer using the language climate change. They are from now on calling it climate crisis.
Ah.
Crisis is, I believe, apropos. Wake up. The house is on fire.
Yes.
Yeah, we're mostly fiddling while Rome burned. That used to be the way people expressed that thing. Oh, it's just Nero fiddling while Rome burns. So
yes, we can all.
We are fiddling away
we
here.
We can all fiddle away in our houses here.
Yeah,
but actually,
fiddling away the future of the planet.
I think we're going to have to attack this problem, attack this crisis. We can do our little bit ourselves, but this needs a global change. This needs a worldwide change of heart.
Well, we have to note that in this whole continent of North America, we have had more rainfall this year from California all the way to the East Coast than has reportedly happened probably since they were counting. I mean, even today, we're grumbling about a little wet weather, but, you know, south of us in Oklahoma and Missouri and Arkansas and Texas, they've had massive tornadoes, which is now supposedly under major flood watch. You know, this is serious stuff for a lot of people, and we're like smugly tucked away in our houses here in Iowa thinking, well, it didn't hit us, but we could be next. Everybody in any place on the planet now could be having unusual weather.
Huh? And thinking about all those food jingles that we grew up on, there was one that says, you can't fool Mother Nature. So, yeah. That's something.
Oh, dear, Lana. Oh, dear.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
What is this world coming to? That's what my mother always used to say.
And we're here to see it, too. Today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we talked about lots of different news things, good things, bad things. We talked about rhubarb. We talked about Jack in the Pulpit. Donna and I will be hitting the road for some interviews and maybe coming to a town near you. So stay tuned to upcoming shows. Also coming up this weekend, a barn dance. Barn dance. Go to the Central Iowa Barn Dance Association Facebook page and find out more there. And there's some Wheatsfield classes at the Food Co-op, one on scones on May 30th, one on wines on June 12th, and an herb walk coming up June 17th. That's at Wheatsfield Co-op.
Oh, yes, and Lon and I are going to be teaching some cooking classes throughout the summer at Cook's Emporium downtown on Main Street as well.
There's always something, always something. Thanks for joining us today. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We get together here every Tuesday noon. Repeated at 7 p.m. on this fine radio station. We had music today by Norman Blake. You heard Billy Gray, Salty, and we'll go out with Elzik's Farewell. Oh, some fine guitar music. Support KHOI. If we are in your ears, put us in your heart. We get by with help from you. This is community-run, community-financed, community-supported radio. Rhubarb, it's the season. Make a pie, Donna. I'm going to make a pie.
With a lard crust.
With a lard crust.
Absolutely.
My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.